This is the Made of Clay Report, and today we're having a Facing Our Lives issue with Peaches Gillette, our co-host, and I'm Eric Clay, and three guests, Lori Konwinski, Sherry Andes, and Don Barber, and I'm going to have them introduce themselves in just a second. We're going to take up food, and food is a topic that up until recent years has evoked a tremendous amount of nostalgia in this country and gotten in the way of our understanding. Because our small food producers really collapsed just after World War I. And our food system has been taken over by industrial agriculture, which is highly efficient. It produces food that can have a long shelf life, but it's not necessarily healthy food. Also, it separated people from their relationship with food, raising it, handling it, preparing it, having it in their own traditions. And it's done a lot of damage to the environment. But every few years, we come around to something in this country called the Farm Bill. And our panelists are going to discuss what the Farm Bill is and what we can do to influence it and why it matters.
Just look at all those hungry mouths we have to feed. Take a look at all the suffering we breed. So many lonely faces scattered all around, searching for what they need. Is this the world we created? What did we do it for? Is this the world we invaded? Against the law, so it seems. Sitting on his throne, waiting for life to go by.
So, Lori, take it over. Take it away.
Hello, so nice to be with you. So my name is Lori Konwinski. I serve as Justice and Peace Ministry Coordinator here at Catholic Charities in Tompkins County. And we're delighted to let you know that we are co-sponsoring an event coming up on Monday, November 14, on this issue of the Farm Bill to help our community understand its importance, its impact, and how they can have a voice in it. Our goal being that this Farm Bill would be even better than Farm Bills in the past, that it would help more people access food and do it in a way that is more just and more sustainable. So it's going to be at 7 o'clock on Monday at St. John's Episcopal Church in the parish hall. People know that space as the Loaves and Fishes dining room. So we'd love to have you join us there at 7 p.m. on Monday.
And Sherry.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sherry Andes, and I am the senior regional organizer for an organization called Bread for the World. And Bread for the World is a national advocacy organization. We work in every state in the nation, including New York, and we work closely with a bread team in Ithaca. And we are an advocacy organization. We work to convince our national legislative delegations to do everything they can to end hunger and food insecurity in this nation and abroad. And we're one of the co-sponsors of the event that Lori just referenced. And I'm really happy to be here with you all today.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Don.
Yes, my name is Don Barber, and I've been an elected official as a town supervisor in the town of Caroline. I've also I've been a farmer for the bulk of my life. Currently have a farm in Brooktondale that I work with my draft horses. But most recently, my connection with the food system has been through the Food Policy Council, which is an advocacy group in Tompkins County. And we were able to get funding from Tompkins County Legislature, as well as Community Foundation of Tompkins County, to develop a food system plan, which was just completed this year. We're in the middle of rolling it out and describing it to the community. And it speaks to many of the issues that we'll be talking about today, but it's really designed to understand our local food system and set directions for the future, and has a number of goals and recommendations to get there.
Right.
Thank you.
So, and Peaches, you haven't introduced yourself on the show for a while. Would you like to do that?
Yeah, I am Peaches Gillette, and I am actually only been at Ithaca for the last 5 years. I'm primarily a poet, and I do race relations workshops throughout the county. I sit on the Dryden School Board, and I am now the part of the UU as the co-director of Congregational Life. It's nice to meet you.
So let's get started. What is the Farm Bill, and why should we care about it?
Great, I'll take that one, Eric. Mm-hmm. So the Farm Bill is an omnibus multi-year law, and it governs an array of agriculture and food programs. And it provides an opportunity every 5 years for policymakers and advocates to comprehensively and periodically address agriculture and food policy. And there are really three things that I want people to know about the Farm Bill. One is that it's a $500 billion piece of legislation, which I don't know if you can get your mind around that, but it's difficult for me to get my mind around that $500 billion. It's enormous. And as such, it has lots of interests, attached to it, right? Farmers, lobby groups, food producers at a large scale, banks, insurance companies, nonprofits, industry lobbies, lots of groups trying to influence that $500 billion. The second thing, which has already been mentioned, is that it's reauthorized every 5 years. And that's important because it means that every 5 years, there's an opportunity to influence what happens in this nation's food system. And we have an opportunity to make real changes. And we can talk about what kind of food we subsidize, how deeply we subsidize it, how much do we care about nutrition programs like SNAP, which is the old food stamps program, and what about climate change, which is something that we all know is critically important to farmers and to everybody in this country and abroad. So the Farm Bill is something that we can take a big bite out of every year. So those three things, $500 billion, reauthorized every 5 years, and an opportunity for change.
So in terms of, it touches every aspect of the food we see in supermarkets, as well as the food that's provided in school lunch programs, as well as the food that the access to people who are getting supplemental nutritional assistance. Every aspect of food this bill touches. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, and it's important because if you think about the food that it touches, 60% of crops in this country are subsidized as commodity crops. So those are, you started to refer to them in the intro, processed, highly processed food, animal feed and ethanol in the form of corn, soybeans, sugar, wheat, potatoes. And these are, not the most healthy foods for us to eat, but they are the cheapest.
They can be produced at volume.
They can be produced at volume. Right, right. That's right. But we also know that to meet the nutritional needs of all Americans in this country, we need to double the amount of fruits and vegetables that we eat. And only 2% of crops in this country are fruits and vegetables, which is pretty amazing. So the Farm Bill also has something to do with what's not grown in this country because of the way the subsidy structure is put together. And then the other piece that I think people may not realize is that the SNAP program, the food stamp program, reaches 13% of the population in this country. 41,500,000 people in this country are on SNAP, which is, you know, a pretty a big chunk of our population.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Lori, you're gonna take what's the impact on Tompkins County of the food bill?
Well, the most important one, because the Farm Bill is predominantly the SNAP program. Certainly, it funds many other things, but by far the biggest bulk of the Farm Bill's funding goes to SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, what we used to call food stamps, as we're saying. It's important to recognize what that means on the local level. So here in Tompkins County, as of August, which was the most recent stats, there were 4,535 households receiving SNAP benefits, which translated to over 7,700 people. So in a population of approximately 105,000 people here in Tompkins County, that's about 7% of our neighbors who rely on SNAP to help them put food on their table. So it's certainly not going to cover people's entire food bill. It's supplemental is right there in its name. So it's not meant to cover all the food that a mother needs to buy for her family, or even a single elderly person, or someone who's just maybe coming out of homelessness and trying to make a life for himself or herself. But at least it is an assistance that helps with affording some of that nutritional food. So that's really the single biggest impact. We have also, through our Cornell Cooperative Extension here in Tompkins County, a program called GusNIP, which is basically a pilot program across the country to incentivize fresh fruit and vegetables for low-income people. It's sort of a dollar-to-dollar match. If you spend a dollar on produce, you get another dollar to spend on produce. This is a pilot effort, and our Cooperative Extension Office is one of the few places around the country that's involved in doing some follow-up research on how it works. So that's one more way that it affects our county, because if we can show how great this is for health, particularly children's health, that's going to, we hope, encourage Congress to expand this really positive and we think very impactful program.
Right. And so part of the reason to build awareness locally for this event is this program. And if you can show impact, you can also influence the Farm Bill in Washington. We have a little over half the users of on SNAP, people signed, enrolled in SNAP percentage wise in Tompkins County compared to the national statistics that Sherry gave us. But the reason that we is so important here at this moment is the innovation. Okay.
Yeah, I think both. I really think both. And of course, in our county, so much of our population is comprised of the college student body, that if we don't include those young people who are often mostly only here, you know, half or three quarters of the year, much higher percentage of our permanent residents who are making use of SNAP.
Right, right. And yes, I mean, you take away a third of the population as students, then yes, and even some of them are eligible for SNAP. That's what I, okay, yes. Peaches, were you speaking up? Or
yeah, I was thinking back to something Sherry said, and I was wondering if you could, you were talking about how there's control over what is grown at times. And I would love it if you can walk me through that process. How does that happen? How do they decide what to control? And what are kind of like the negative and positive effects of that, if there are any positive effects at all?
Well, control is really around the subsidies. Eric, did you want to add to that? You were raising your hand. Okay. Yeah, it's really around the subsidies and how much incentive you can get to grow something. So if you're incentivized, then it makes it easier to actually grow the crop. And I see Don is looking to get in here, yeah. So he may have something to add to that as well.
Sure. I just wanted to pick up on some comments that Lori made. When we were characterizing the food system in Tompkins County, we learned that 62% of SNAP eligible residents are not in the SNAP program. So the numbers that you gave, Lori, are just a snippet of what the opportunities are in Tompkins County. We were able to determine that 12% of our residents are food insecure. And within that, so we have the SNAP program and the residents that can be enrolled in it, because it's not, there are so many different thresholds you have to meet to be enrolled in a SNAP, that one third of the folks that are food insecure are not able to even access SNAP funds. So we have structurally, there's a number of issues locally that we need to deal with.
Oh, that's done. Really important.
Mm. Yes. So let's turn back now to what is this event next week, and how do people, you know, who do you want to see there? What do we want to accomplish next week? Lori.
Well, we'd like to fill that parish hall, obviously, with people from our local faith communities as well as other people, to get them both educated and then, we hope, excited and activated to speak out as we enter this new congressional session in the new year. We think there are a lot of really good-hearted people involved in our food pantry system, which is pretty amazing here in our county, and in other efforts through faith communities and other wonderful community groups to feed people who are food insecure. But the next step then is to help people understand what our government is doing and how we can have an effect on that, right? To make that even more impactful on people who are going hungry. You know, all of the direct service charity work is only a very small percentage of food assistance compared to public dollars. So as hard as we work to gather those Thanksgiving baskets for people, we have to work even harder to ensure that the whole big system works, especially for the people on the margins. So our hope is that people will walk away knowing more about the Farm Bill, knowing more specifically about this GusNIP program and what the importance of SNAP, as well as the ways it could be improved to lower some of the barriers to receive it, and to think about the environmental impacts also of our food system. And we hope then that they will join Bread for the World and get really excited to continue to be an advocate against hunger.
Right, right. So what are some of the specific practices that need to be changed or that need to be challenged, Sherry?
So I guess there are two ways to think about that question. There's the policies that we want to change, and then there's the habits of political life that we want to change. Should I talk about the policies first, Eric?
Well, you, it's your call. It's very interesting the way you split it up as the policies versus the habits of political life. So let's go.
Okay. All right. So Lori has lifted up a number of policies that, are really important to Tompkins County and to Bread for the World. The way we're really thinking about the food system and the Farm Bill is in three areas that we want to really emphasize: nutrition, equity, and sustainability, climate. And then we have a number of priorities under each of those priority areas. So in terms of nutrition, and this goes to some of what you're saying, Don, about SNAP eligible folks. I mean, there are folks who have who experience barriers to getting SNAP simply because they're eligible and they're not able to access it for bureaucratic reasons, for logistical reasons, for language reasons, for all the things that I'm sure your study and your experience have uncovered. But then there are people who are not eligible for SNAP, who we believe should be, for whom there are these SNAP exclusions. And that includes, people who have been in this country legally, but for less than 5 years. And so they're not eligible to access SNAP. It includes people who, not in New York, but in the country, in different states, like Florida, for example, who have a drug felony and have come out of prison, they're not eligible for SNAP. And we think that's wrong. And they're across the country, it should be more like New York, where they're eligible for SNAP and right away. And so we want to regularize that across the country. We want to see that students who meet the requirements for eligibility don't have to work. There's currently a work requirement for students. And students are working hard enough to earn their degrees. So we want to make sure that they're eligible for SNAP. So those are some of the exclusions that we want to take on. And certainly the student exclusion would be important to Ithaca and Tompkins County. So that's something that we really want to see. Also in terms of nutrition, would be a priority for ours is the GustNet program. We actually don't think it should be a pilot anymore because we think that the jury is in about the fact that this is a really successful program. And that, guess what? When you incentivize people to buy fruits and vegetables, they buy fruits and vegetables. And so we think that this program should be, the barriers to expansion of this program should be removed and it should be really expanded nationwide. And so those are some of the nutritional programs that we're really looking to prioritize. In terms of equity, we're really excited about the idea of working with small shareholder farmers to help them with access to farmland and credit and markets and technical assistance for beginning and socially disadvantaged farmers. We think that's really important. We want to make sure that they have equal access to be able to farm in this country. And we think we should designate an equity commission as a permanent body for ongoing promotion of racial and gender equity within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So that has to do with equity. And then in terms of climate, we're really interested in tackling food waste. Food waste is maybe not intuitively related to climate, but it's so much related to climate. Because if you think about the whole food system, when food is left in the fields, so food waste from the fields, you have all of the CO2 that was generated for the production of that food. And then when it's wasted in terms of ending up in landfills, you have the methane that is released. And 40% of America's food is wasted. A full 40% of America's food is wasted. So that is creating a lot of havoc with climate. And it also relates to hunger, right? Think about the people that could be fed with that food. So we have a number of policies related to food waste that we're looking to implement.
And that number may be shocking to people, but it's always been high. As much as 50% of food was wasted in the fields before we had a food processing or preservation, you know, canning and freezing and stuff in place. And then as that became more available, we wasted more in the processing, and now we waste most of our food at the consumer end, which is, I think, what you're trying to get a handle on. And we'll come up with more of that later. Peaches, were you about to say something?
Yeah. Does any of this farm bill cover, when you talk about food waste and, you know, my life working in schools, which is a huge place where food is wasted. Some schools do much better than others. They have food weighing programs and they watch what the children are taking when they're on the cafeteria line. But does any of the farm bill cover some of the regulations? Because there are regulations in some places that tell schools that they can't reuse food, even if they're not used at all. Like even packet, like if they have packaged muffins, once the day is at the end, that muffin goes in the garbage. Does the farm bill cover any of those? Right? There's so much stuff that gets thrown in the garbage that's perfectly good food.
I don't know the answer to that, but I think not. I think not. There's a separate bill called the I'm forgetting the name of it, but there's a separate bill out there that is meant to help restaurants and grocery stores be able to donate food without fear of retaliation, lawsuits. And that bill is being revamped to make it a little bit easier for it to be used. And we could look into whether schools could take advantage of that law, because the point you're making is really good.
And one of the biggest issues in elementary schools, we had a composting program in a school system, and the biggest waster in the composting program were the elementary school students, and they were given trays of food. They did not get to pick their own. And because they were mandated what they were given, they wasted a lot of food. It wasn't appropriate for their ages, but they couldn't do otherwise. And that's a New York state law, I think. I don't think that's a federal. Don.
So I wanted just to add a little color locally about food waste. So it turns out that just the unused food portion of food contributes 4% of the greenhouse gas emissions around the world. So it's pretty significant if you're trying to manage greenhouse gas to be thinking about that food. And locally, we have the Cuga Compost operation, and they have this past year accepted 3.4 million pounds of food to be composted. Give you an idea, that's just local food that's being discarded. There are programs locally, like the Friendship Donation Network, that rescue on an average of 1,400 pounds of food per day and then distribute it within the community. So there are local efforts that are taking place. And the other, I guess, thing that may be of some importance is that the Tompkins County Legislature has approved the funding for a staff person at the Materials Resource and Recovery Department to just focus on food waste. So there'll be an initiative locally to work on that. And I wanted just to speak, I just make one comment about the Farm Bill. It's so important that we do leverage federal money, public money, whether it's from the federal government or from the state government or local governments, to support our food initiatives that are taking place. But there is so much we can do at the local level without requiring those programs to be brought in from the federal level, that we just can use their funds and then continue to advance our local programs.
I can say we're very proud to have Megan Sheehan Rosen, who is the coordinator of the Friendship Donation Network, on our panel at our event on Monday to speak exactly on this. They do amazing work, Don. Thank you for lifting them up. And aren't we blessed in our community to have that already organized system with the grocery stores and other food retailers and producers set up to distribute that food? I can guarantee you that's not everywhere in America, and that's the sort of thing that needs to happen.
Right.
Yep. But she will be speaking specifically on that.
Sherry, you wanted to bring up what are the habits of political life, and Don is pushing us there too, because you know we can take dollars, but we have a political culture in Tompkins County that's allowing some things to be explored. But you're raising the bigger picture issue where the larger amounts of money are at stake. What are the political habits, the habits of political life that we need to address and that you'll be addressing at this meeting?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for reminding me to come back to that, Eric. So many Americans, I believe, think that there's not much they can do to influence these big, you know, $500 trillion bill, for example. It feels like, you know, the elephant in the room, and all they can see is the tip of the tail. And, you know, what can you do with a tip of a tail of an elephant? And to a certain degree, that may be true. What can you do as an individual with the tip of the tail of an elephant? But if you can cultivate the habit of political participation that is collective, that in which you, I mean, it used to be in this country that political parties were a way to join in collective action, and people still declare themselves Democrat or Republican, but who goes to a precinct meeting anymore, right? It used to be that the party platform came up from the ground, and people had ward and precinct operations, and you know, they were involved in local politics. None of that exists in this country anymore. You know, how do you get involved in a collective? And Bread for the World is one such collective. It's a place where you can join with others. And there are other collectives. It's a place where you can join with others and take on a larger political issue in concert. We write 90,000 letters a year to Congress on any one particular issue. And we do local visits to Congress all across the country, in every state, on one issue that we're all united around. Mm. If people can begin to think that they can make a difference, and that they can do that in collaboration with others, and that they need to learn about issues and act on issues in relationship with a community, I think that is a fundamental American way of doing public life.
That is a very strong, we have not heard that message in a long time. And when you come together to orchestrate a set of opinions, you may not agree about the fine details of what policy should be changed in what way, but you can tell the legislators that they need to move the needle. And there's a lot of room to move the needle, and having thousands of people putting their voices together, which is what you're saying in terms of orchestrating and a collective voice. It's not one voice, but it's a whole symphony of voices.
That's right. It's beautiful.
Lori, that's your work.
We just got through Election Day, and there are still obviously races to be called. But I think it's incumbent upon all of us not to just turn our attention now to something else. Right. We have to pay attention to who our new representatives are, it's a whole new ballgame. It's going to be a whole new legislature in Albany and a whole new congressional session. So, you know, people around the country have new representatives in the House, new senators. We also have some new members of our assembly in Albany and members of our state Senate. So we all need to pay attention and learn who those people are and figure out how we as residents in this community can join forces and build relationships with those elected officials. And obviously, as Sherry's saying, doing it collectively is a lot more impactful. So, you know, that's our first task, I think. Who now is going to represent us? Where do they stand on issues? How do we find common ground and get them, you know, on board with some of the things that we think are so important for them to do? And to pay attention to what they're doing, what is going on in our communities, what's going on in the news. We all, I think, have to step our game up a little bit and pay more attention. And, you know, even pay attention to news from different sources so that we're getting not just our own echo chamber back at us. But all of that is part of, you know, civic engagement, civic responsibility.
Right. And because Bread for the World is a national organization, this may matter more to Bread for the World than it may in a traditionally blue state like New York. But we are divided pretty equally nationally on how people believe we should engage the major issues of the day. And we may need as a nation to figure out multiple ways to do that. But we have a farm bill that's coming up for renewal, and there are specific policies that people can care about across the political spectrum if you can have those conversations. We're going to take that issue up more explicitly in the next segment, but is there anything other than to acknowledge that this is an inflection point with the election? And this is also the timing of this push, is you want people geared up so that when those politicians take office in January, you're already ready to meet them. Right?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Okay. So, and it doesn't matter what party they're from.
No, I mean, fortunately, unfortunately, hunger, food insecurity is a bipartisan issue.
That's right.
If it's not, it should be.
That's right.
Let's take a break for music and we'll come back to the next segment.
13 million kids in the United States struggle with hunger. This equates to one in every six kids. Hungry kids struggle socially, behaviorally, and their experiences are less enjoyable. Let me tell you about one. Woke up this morning, one thought in my head. As I pushed back the covers and hopped out of bed, my belly's telling me something, maybe I should listen. Put your slippers on and go into the kitchen, let's eat. But hold up, we ain't been shopping, we don't got no food, we don't got no options, man. I laugh, but it's not too funny, having to go the whole day feeling hungry, that's crummy. Tummy's growling, nobody's smiling, I feel like this is an everyday challenge for kids like me. See, I wish we could feast, but the food's not here, man, it's nothing to eat. Now my stomach is weak and my mind is too, and I can't really think cause my mind's on food, it's true. Reality is sad and it's bleak, but nothing really matters when you don't have nothing to eat. Nothing to eat. My days ain't complete when I don't have nothing to eat. Nothing to eat. You know this life ain't sweet when you don't have nothing to. Nothing to eat. My days ain't complete when I don't have nothing to eat. Nothing to eat. You know this life ain't sweet when you don't have nothing to eat. Outside with the homies chilling, words can't describe how I'm feeling. I need something filling, more than just food for thought. Cause real talk, I thought food was for everyone. Burden weighing on me, it's a heavy one. No idea where the next meal's coming from. They telling me to think about my future, but I'm too busy thinking about my right now. And tummy growling, nobody smiling. I feel like this is an everyday challenge for kids like me. See, I wish we could feast,
But the food's not here, man, I can't even eat. Now my stomach is weak and my mind is too. It's impossible to think cause my mind's on food. It's true, reality is sad and it's bleak. Cause nothing really matters when you don't have nothing to eat.
Nothing to eat, my days incomplete when I don't have nothing to eat. Nothing to eat, you know this life ain't sweet when you don't have nothing to. Nothing to eat, my days incomplete when I don't have nothing to eat. Nothing to eat, you know this life ain't sweet when you don't have nothing to.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, and the topic is the Farm Bill and Bread for the World and Catholic Charities and other religious groups in Tompkins County helping to organize an effort to influence the Farm Bill, which will be renewed in 2023. So the next focal point is, how do we propose to get awareness about the changes that need to be made to get some pressure in place? How are you proposing to act on this movement, to make it a movement?
Yeah. So, you know, to make real change and big change, I would submit that you need three things in place. First of all, a lot of people need to believe that something needs to change. That's important. And so, you know, in Tompkins County, that's why we're doing this event. We're trying to raise awareness about the importance of the food system, what needs to change, and the vehicle of the Farm Bill as leverage for that change. So that's why we're doing that this event. That's why this show is so important, is to raise that awareness. And across the country, we think there's a moment here. COVID has unmasked food insecurity in this country. People are more aware that there's 42 million people who are food insecure in this country. And, you know, that there's 13 million children, one in six, who are food insecure. The President of the United States has just held a White House conference on this, the first one in 50 years, and you know, rallied the whole nation around a plan to end hunger by 2030. And that's garnered a lot of publicity and attention and press across the country. So we think there's a moment here where we have the opportunity to do something big. So that's the first thing. A lot of people have to know, a lot of people have to care. The second thing is there have to be some practical solutions to the problem. There have to be some ideas, some good ideas. And we think we've got some good ideas. Some other folks have some good ideas out there. You're never gonna have you know, a solution to the whole problem, you know. Even Jesus said the poor will be with us always. We're always going to be struggling to, you know, work on this issue. But there are things we can do. We can move the needle. The child tax credit taught us that. You know, we made a real difference around poverty in this nation. So there are policies we can put in place to make a difference. So we think we've come up with some good ideas here. We think that the pilot GusNIP program has really shown that you can increase people's buying power around fruits and vegetables, for example. The third thing you need is political leaders willing to and in whose interest it is to enact those policies. And that's where bread comes in. You know, we help build the political will to incentivize political leaders to do the right thing and enact these policies. And so we've been working quietly for 6 months behind the scenes to get ready for this campaign. We're going to officially launch it on December 6th. And in the spring, we will begin our letter writing campaign, that'll move into in-district meetings with legislators and an advocacy summit in June.
Can you unpack what you mean by political will?
Ooh.
I mean, it's a catchphrase, but
a catchphrase. Well, what does political will mean? It means that, there's a, not everybody, but there's a critical mass of decision makers who agree that something needs to change, and they're willing to leverage their power to do it. Right. That's what I believe.
So political will rests with the legislators and the bureaucrats who both shape and define what this policy is. There has to be a will among them to do it. So how do you then shape that will? How do you get them to pay attention or to believe that this is actually a moment for them to do something?
You want to take a crack at it, Lori?
Is mobilizing people on the margins, that those stories get heard, that it isn't an abstraction, that the people who are elected to serve hear from those who are really getting the short end of the stick of this system, right? Who don't have the resources to get ahead and have a decent life in our very, very wealthy country. One of the people that will be speaking next Monday is a woman whose family owns a farm. She and her husband have 5 children. They lost their dairy farm. They now are doing a beef cattle farm, but they were in terrible financial strain with the economics of farming being what they are. And she had to go and sign up for SNAP. And when you hear her talk about how much it meant to her to be able to do that, like how much it meant that stress of trying to figure out how am I going to make ends meet was somehow, not erased, but at least mitigated to a degree. It's just very powerful. So I think that part of our work is not just raising our voices, but getting the voices of people directly affected into the ears of the decision makers. I think, as Sherry said, hunger has to be a bipartisan issue and has been, for many years in this country. Everybody likes to eat and nobody wants to go hungry. And I think because that's such a basic human need and a human experience, people can kind of begin to get that. But that doesn't mean that they really know what it means to not be able to feed their kids or to just not know where the next meal is coming from. So that's part of our job, I feel, as advocates, as people trying to stand with people on the margins.
Right. Go ahead, Peaches.
I kept going back to the idea of the first thing that Sherry said about getting people to believe, because part of the biggest problem is getting people who are really sitting on the front lines of hunger to believe that people care enough to make a difference for them. And that's just the history of the disconnection between mm-hmm. the people who are struggling, the people who are in power. And so you have to meet those people, like you're all saying, on the ground, and to start telling them not to just believe, but to show them the steps that take you to the goal, to mm-hmm. say that if we can do this and this and this, and those things are doable, they can get us where we need to go. And that, to me, it needs to be a very powerful part of any movement toward trying to feed people or anything else, is to get people to believe that you're really going to really work in their behalf and you have a plan, not some, pie in the sky, like we hope to feed the whole world. But where is your plan? What are the steps that we need to take, that we can take as simple people, right? As people who may be poor or uneducated or whatever it is, how can we take those steps with you to make those things happen?
That is so important, Peaches, because you know what? We don't need to teach people how to lose.
Right.
Right. People lose enough. We need to teach people how to win. And that's what you just said is so critical. It's so important. We don't need to set people up for failure.
Yeah. We are in despair to begin with. Right. And the last thing we need is another blow to us believing that things can change. People are losing hope constantly. It's like they're bleeding out. And right. So anything that gets put in place has to be, to me, simplified in a way that people say, oh yeah, I see I can be a part of that. I see I can do that too. You know, right. Everybody, you know, I used to say that everybody, you know, in order to make change in with racism, everyone doesn't have to be Martin Luther King, which is what we used to believe, that if you weren't a powerful orator or a powerful leader, that you couldn't make change. Simple people need to know, I have a hand in this. I have a say in this, and I can help make those changes.
Yep. Very, very good. Very good.
Don, you want to jump in here?
Sure. So it's great to hear this, the strategy for moving forward and connecting a broad group of people to speak to the legislators and so on. But I think one thing we should is understand the background of how we got to where we are. Back in the 50s and 60s and before that, the United States government felt that we had to protect the breadbasket of the United States, which was a number of small farmers. And but then we developed fertilizers and so on, which allowed people to grow a lot of food in and do it efficiently. And so in the early 1970s, the U.S. changed its agricultural policy from protecting the breadbasket and all the farmers to, as Earl Butz, the Secretary of Agriculture, said, get bigger, get out. And they embraced large agricultural operations that would be efficient to try to keep the price of food down. So we have been living with that strategy ever since the 1970. And it exists today. And so many of the problems that we talk about come about because we no longer have an agrarian economy in rural America. We just have large businesses. Globally, the food system is a $6 trillion business. Nationally, it's a $2 billion business. And it's controlled by huge agricultural, agribusiness, multinational corporations. And so when we speak to our legislators, we need to recognize who's pushing from the other side. And think about our language that we use as legislators to talk about envisioning a food system that's different than the one we have right now. And and all the things that you've mentioned, Sherry, are exactly the things that we came up with also with our local work that we had done. Whenever we talk about food system, I thought maybe I'd throw in a couple of other interesting facts that we picked up. 90% of the food that we consume in Tompkins County is not produced locally or even regionally. The average distance that travels to our plate is 1,500 miles. And so everyone in Tompkins County is impacted by the food system that's run by corporations and not a local food system. So whenever folks want to change the food system, we'll talk about the little things they can do. Speaking to legislatures is definitely important because that speaks to how the public money will be allocated. But also every day, all of us make a decision on what we put in our mouths, what we buy at the grocery store. And those decisions predict the food system that we want in the future. So it should be also part of our message that we can change the food system locally by the choices that we make.
Right. I want to go back to where you started, Don. And there's kind of an old saw, you can organize for money or you can organize for feet. You know, you bring money in, you can pay for things. And that's what a lot of the corporate sponsors of our politicians are doing. Or you can bring in a lot of feet, a lot of people. And the two are you can't do them both equally because they have different incentives. But the incentives to organize people or feet are their stories and their compelling stories and how you can hear them into the mainstream and listen them into a kind of normalcy from the margins into the center. So how exactly are we going to do that? How are we going to listen from the margins into the center so that the feet have a chance up against the money? Maybe that's too crass.
Well, I think there are a couple of pretty practical ways. The first thing I want to do is just affirm the strategy. There's a political scientist out of UC Berkeley by the name of David Brockman, and he's done some really good research on how you change people's minds. And it doesn't, turns out it doesn't have to do with the ways most of us think you do it, right? Making a good political argument and, you know, setting up your rhetoric point by point. But it has exactly to do with listening really well and sharing your story in an empathetic way that connects with the other person's story. So it's not just sharing your story, but it's listening to the other person's story and connecting your story to theirs. It's two pieces. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really interesting. And I think you do it by, you know, bringing folks with lived experience into meetings with legislators. You know, you bring them by bringing legislators out to local communities, you know, on different issues. I was part of a team that helped to bring in universal health care in the state of Massachusetts, and we did all kinds of things. We had small group meetings in churches where we brought, you know, five or six uninsured folks, and we brought legislators out in the church to meet with people. You know, we lined up instead of in a hearing in the state house, instead of having a panel, we lined up 10 people and had them go to the mic and just say, I'm so-and-so, I'm uninsured, I've, you know, had this experience, but speak just for a minute, and had 10 of them, you know, to make an impact. There are lots of ways to tactically include people with lived experience in the political process. But the why the churches are so important is because the churches have contact with folks with lived experience and relationships with people with lived experience, and they can support them and shepherd them through this process in a way that doesn't abandon them, as Peaches was making a point of saying, you know, accompanies them through the process in an appropriate way, so that they're not being exploited.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is really important.
And it's also a chance. There's an evangelical pastor who worked in inner city Chicago, and he had a practice of taking one or two people from his neighborhood whenever he traveled anywhere. So they got to tell their stories outside and to travel with him in a way that was safe and secure. But they also got to hear the stories of other people's experiences, which, and when we're marginalized, we don't hear what's happening at the center. We don't know how it works. And we need, and we also need to it's mutual. Mm-hmm. It's not a one-way communication, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
As you build this community of listeners, how do you expect the community to pressure those who need to have the political will to make a difference? I mean, I can see your organizing strategy. I can see people hearing and beginning to care about things they maybe didn't know they needed to care about, and beginning to maybe take action. But how are they actually going to aim that concern in a way that might impact the political will? Either of you, Laurie, Jerry?
Well, I'm thinking about an example from an issue that BREAD took on last year, which was the Global Malnutrition Treatment and Prevention Act, which is a global bill aimed around hunger in an international space. And I'm thinking about a team in Maryland that was working with two of their senators who both are on the Foreign Relations Committee. So an important committee that has, jurisdiction over the bill. So really important decision makers. And they didn't have a relationship with those senators. So they couldn't even meet with those senators. So in the course of a year, they did offering what we call an offering of letters, which is nothing more than getting congregations, churches to write letters as a group. We call it an offering of letters because as churches and congregations, we encourage them to liturgicize it, right? Mm-hmm. To make it part of the liturgy. So that it's part of the community's offering. And so they generated, Maryland generated about 7,000 letters, which is pretty incredible, to their senators. And then they followed up with meetings to the staff of those senators, where they met in small groups. And then requested meetings with the senators themselves and were able to get meetings with the senators because of the letters and because of the small group meetings with the staff. And so at Advocacy Day, they met with both of their senators and they were able to get their senators to co-sponsor those bills. And those were key senators in the key committee that needed to pass that bill. So that was a very important example of how that worked.
You know, it's interesting that when people, and this is just a timeless concept, that when people are rumbling enough in the background,
mm-hmm.
they will get a response. Now, it could be one of two responses, but often they get a response. It's like all the movements that have taken place, like they start quietly, when somebody doesn't even pay attention to what's going on, it moves into a larger roar of people saying, we're not taking this anymore, we need help, whatever it is. And people will respond. You know, the powers that be will respond. They can respond one of two ways, but often they will respond in a way to quell that rumbling. Mm-hmm. And they'll do that, whether it's a perfect solution or not, they'll do that by trying to make some appeasement. So that's what it made me think of when you were speaking.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you're able to give them an action which is positive, yes. and potential in their power to take without a lot of retribution, they'll take it.
Right. Right. You're not vying to control what they do. You're just trying to give them an action that they can do that'll move the agenda forward.
Exactly. Which is why I said you need a good idea. You need people to think there's a problem, and you need people whose interest it is to take that action.
Right.
It's an invitation, I think. It's an invitation to be part of something bigger than themselves, to be part of the civic life of this country. And to take their power. I mean, it's on some level, it's not empowering people. It's just saying, you've got this power, use it. Recognize you have it and go speak up, because that's what it means to live in a democracy.
Right. And in a profound sense, that's as important, or perhaps more important, if we had those conversations than occasional voting. Because if those conversations were had on a regular basis, we would have a sense of where we need to be moving collectively, mm-hmm. for decision makers, those with the who could have the political will to actually make mm-hmm. the decisions.
And to Don's excellent point about consumer power, that's, even more so, we vote, as someone taught me years ago, we vote every couple of years, but we buy something pretty much every day, right? So, all of that, all of the same piece of like all of that power that we have, let's take it to shape the kind of society we want to live in, including the kind of leaders we elect and what they do once we have them in power, even if maybe they weren't our choice. Maybe we didn't vote for any given leader, but that leader is still accountable to the people.
Right.
And in having those conversations, having those conversations, you get people to also believe that they are in fact part of a collective force, where often people don't see that they're part of it. You know, they feel separated from most things that are going on around them in one way or the other, maybe in small little groups, they're part of something. But when you have those conversations, people realize, oh my gosh, that person is on the same page, or that person thinks the same way. And we are a collective force. And that means something. It always means something.
Mm. And so the real change would be both making an incremental change in policy, but also making a change in perception that I can be allied with people who are on the red or the blue or the independent side of things. And we can do something together because we care, not in exactly the same way, not about all the big picture items, but about this one thing we can work together. And that's not what our Congress is doing right now, at least hasn't done for a while. The main strategy for Bread for the World is to work through congregations. And that's how it got started back in the 60s, I believe, was working through religious organizations, congregations to have this concert or this offering of letters to influence policy. Ithaca is a non-religious majority county. And how do we actually invite people into this process to get involved who are not part of religious congregations?
Yeah, it's a really good question. We have an initiative called the Next Gen Project, which is aimed at young people. So we have a real interest in connecting with, and young people is loosely defined. But we have a real interest in connecting with, folks under 30. And so we're looking actively to discern how to do that. Certainly college campuses are a way that we're looking to connect with young people. But also, ongoing fraternities and sororities, which have, active membership even after graduation, clubs, other institutions that young people connect with. There are young professional associations, things like that, that we're more interested in trying to relate to. So, and individuals can relate to us, but they need to kind of connect to an institution. Mm-hmm. They need to be willing to connect up, not necessarily belong to, but connect up.
And this is, so the way you have positioned Bread for the World, and I think it's something that's worth noting, is in the past, we've tended to see our political allegiances and our cultural allegiances as being pretty monolithic. And yet as individuals, we can act on a whole variety of concerns that our family members, our friends, our congregation members, our people, we can have opinions and practices that are at odds with people close to us. And you're allowing for that to happen. What's happened with congregations over the last 20 years in Tompkins County is, or maybe the last 40 years, they've gotten smaller, but they've also gotten more ideologically pure, as it were. And that's whether it's red or blue or whatever. And there's not as much internal difference, not as much internal necessarily, hearing voices of various margins within the congregations. How do you, and we saw some research locally that tried to reach out to some of the more conservative congregations, and they had less experience with Bread for the World and less interest. How do we think about addressing that? And I know you weren't necessarily anticipating that question. I just saw this last week, so.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll take a crack at it, and then Lori, you can take a crack at it too. I think that, again, it goes back to relationships. It goes back to building a relationship with the pastor and key leaders in the congregation itself. Not making assumptions about one another. reaching out individually without making assumptions, getting to know each other on a human level, making a human connection. And from there, invitationally, seeing if there's mutual interest in the work that we're doing. So, you know, sometimes there is, and sometimes there isn't, but that's the process.
Right. And I think you have, yes, I think that's my understanding. What I've seen in the more conservative congregations is they more often have gardens of grace where mm-hmm. they will have food that their members have raised that they give away free at locations mm-hmm. that are available to people, and having relationships around raising food could build relationships around the context of the local food security issues. But we haven't really worked that strategy, because they enter the food conversation in a different space. I'm sorry, and I jumped in too soon. Lori.
No, absolutely. Would echo Sherry. It's all about relationships. It's all about being in solidarity with people, showing up for people, showing up for different kinds of community events and spaces where there's a mix of people. And I think then connecting the dots. So we've talked about this bill is not only about feeding the hungry, which every person of faith and every person of good faith, regardless of whether she or he is connected to faith community, ought to care about, right? So that's one. But two is this bill also has environmental sustainability ramifications. So everybody who cares about the environment could be invited to this sort of effort. This bill has racial equity ramifications, because agriculture is an overwhelmingly white occupation in this country, but there are farmers of color and immigrant farmers who just deserve better, who deserve more access to resources so that they can farm. So that's, you know, that's another part of it that people could be attracted to join in. So I think it's also reminding people that, you know, certain religious traditions are engaged in legislative advocacy, and certain religious traditions as a tradition aren't so very much engaged in political advocacy, but that does not mean that individuals within a congregation can't be. Do you see my difference? It doesn't necessarily have to be this particular assembly has to send a representative to meet with a congressman, but that they, as individuals, as citizens, as people we go to saying this is part of, you know, civic engagement, you as an individual can do this. You know, it doesn't have to be in the name of a church. If the church feels like they don't want to, they don't see their calling as being engaged in mm-hmm. the legislative process. I would also argue it's about politics, but it's not about partisanship. And it's important for people to understand the difference. It's not about a party. It's not about a particular elected official. It's about the people affected by this policy, and we're just trying to let people in power know what we think ought to happen.
Right, and a savvy pastor will be able to say to their congregant, that's an issue you care about. We don't have support in the congregation for that issue. We don't need to vote on it as an issue, but go and do, you know, go and take it on and share your experience with others. But it doesn't need to be a policy of the congregation. That is exactly what you're saying, because our politics have gotten too institutionalized around organizations and heavy hammered approaches. And what we need are more subtle stories and listening mm-hmm. and the power, the pressure that can come there. Pardon me, I'll get off my soapbox.
And also, and Eric and I were having a conversation the other day, our politics have seeped more, I think, kind of in a poisonous way into our relationships. So our relationships, even on an individual level, have become politicized. And that's not the way we really build relationships, is by having an opportunity to stand on our personal platforms to my best friend. That's not the way you maintain and build relationships. And I see that happening with individuals. I see that happen with children in school, in the school system where I work. I sit on the school board in Dryden. I see it happening there. And sometimes we have to separate these things out from one another. And there's a time and a place where our politics need to come together. And it's not necessarily in our individual relationships over the dinner table talking about the kind of chicken we bought. So that's always a problem. The other thing is, I'm thinking in terms of like how, you know, that people are still subject to being motivated. You know, we haven't sunk in far enough in despair where we're not. And when we say to people, most people won't tell you that I don't care if everybody goes hungry. You know, they care about hunger. It's a universal concept. It's not like, you know, caring about, you know, I mean, I have to say, this is not even about like caring about what flag somebody's flying. This hunger thing is a universal concept because we can't survive without eating. And so we need to have food, and everybody needs that food, even if it's your neighbor next door, the person who's supplying you with food needs their food. And so the food issue is a really beautiful point of affinity that we can use to help people get involved. And like you said, they don't have to make a commitment to the church to be kind of on the political spectrum, but they can make a commitment as individuals to help move these things forward.
Don, you got your hand up.
I do. So I want to just build on many of the points that have been already made. We were doing a work on our food system, local food system. It's really clear that this was not a partisan issue. It was not a religious issue. This is something that everybody participates in the food system every day. And when we went before the county legislature to ask them to accept our food system plan, they asked for a roll call vote, and every legislator voted in favor of it and all spoke about their interactions and connections with the food system. So it's a very bipartisan issue that's a real opportunity to capitalize on. I think what's important about the ag bill is that it's talking about the distribution of public money to incentivize certain aspects of the food system. And that's how we should be treating our language as we talk to the legislators. We should get to them early to try to control the narrative about what's important in the food system and where the vulnerabilities are that should be addressed with public money. And I think that'll be an effective way, recognizing that there'll be other interests that have a lot of money to be gained by manipulating the system, but trying to get legislators to appreciate the vulnerabilities and how this ag bill can address those.
We're going to take a break for music now, and then we'll come back to more about how we make this walk forward.
Dusty old farmer out working your field, hanging down over your tractor wheel. The sun beating down turned the red paint to orange, and rusty old patches of steel. There's no farmer songs on that car radio, just cowboys, truck drivers, and pain. Well, this is my way to say thanks for the meal, and I hope there's no shortage of rain. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping a face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping a face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song real, from the kid from the city to you. The combines gang up, take most of the bread. Things just ain't like they used to be. Though your kids are out after the American dream, and they're working in big factories. If I come by when you're out in the sun, that you're just like a friend. These days when everyone's taking so much, there's somebody giving back in. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping the face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you. Straw hat and old dirty hankies, mopping the face like a shoe. Thanks for the meal, here's a song that is real, from a kid from the city to you.
This is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, with Peaches Gillette, your co-hosts, and we have Sherry Andes from Bread for the World, Laurie Konwinski from Catholic Charities, and Don Barber with us with the Tompkins County Food System group. I'm blocking on the proper name. Anyway, so let's talk now about how do we engage to have those letter offerings of letters. How do we engage with people reflecting on their food choices? How do we carry that conversation in such a way that says to people who need to have the political will that we're trying to incentivize, we're trying to create an environment where people will make better choices given what we can do now? You know, how do we begin to manufacture, and I may, it's a bad word. How do we begin to cultivate, to host, to invite, to bring people into those conversations locally now? You've got an event coming up Monday, the 14th.
I think that's the first way. We'd love to have people come and learn. We have an amazing panel of speakers, including staff from Cooperative Extension, staff from the Rural Health Network, which is involved in this GusNIP fresh produce incentive program, the Friendship Donations Network staff, as well as a SNAP recipient with her family's personal story. So I think that's the first thing, just to hear both the kind of overview of what the Farm Bill is about and its impact, and Sherry will be speaking on that as well at the event. But also the actual kind of where it hits human life, the impact of it. So that's the first thing. I think come and learn, and then come and also be moved by this whole big issue, which we probably don't think of very much, although we eat every day. So, you know, we need to bring it more under our radar. So that's one thing. And then we will be inviting people to take next steps. As Sherry mentioned, there's a big national Bread for the World event online on December 6th to sort of launch this campaign in anticipation of the new congressional session, to get people educated on those priorities that Bread for the World has developed after having had lots of listening sessions with people around the country for these months. And then getting people just to sign up for the kind of action alerts that Bread for the World extends to people to just as individuals engage in, but then also to invite them to prepare and sign up to bring an offering of letters to their faith community, their student group, their organization, their service club, whatever it may be. So I think we're going to invite people to some, you know, sort of specific next steps. I would also say, another thing that we can do is, as we speak to people who volunteer in food pantries, for example, we have an amazing food pantry system in this county. We're extending invitations to those volunteers to participate in our event, to help them or to inspire them to share the stories of the people they serve, if those people are not, you know, in such a position to be able to share them or feel like they want to or can, but also to then see that big picture, that what they're doing is amazing and important, and it's just one little tiny slice of the anti-hunger effort in this country, to help them realize, as hard as they work to get that food pantry to operate, the monies that go toward anti-hunger, really the great majority of them come through government programs. So that if they care about hunger, and hungry people, then they have to be engaged in that other side of things, as well as the very concrete running of a food pantry.
And could they all have an offering of letters from their food pantry?
I don't see why not. Sure. Yeah. Volunteers could do that. Absolutely.
But also volunteers and recipients. I mean, absolutely. People who are coming to pick up food.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
For people who are unaffiliated, could they have offerings of letters from gatherings in their own homes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it can work with their informal networks.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Oh, sure. And I think, you know, having just come off this election season, a lot of people have gotten used to writing postcards and letters to encourage people to vote. So, you know, maybe this is sort of an extension of that. To continue with that power, like Amnesty International has done for decades, that power of letter writing, if it's a big group or a small group. But what makes it truly powerful is that it's collective, that if different organizations and religious faith communities within Tompkins County all write letters, and then we, as a group, representatives of those different organizations, can go to our new congressman, can go to our senators and say, here are thousands of letters from Tompkins County from different parts of civil society. You know, how powerful that be. So it's not just me writing a letter. It's me writing a letter and putting it in with everybody else's.
Right. And it's and getting out the vote is a, quote, nonpartisan thing, although there were partisan groups actually pushing to do it. Food is slightly more partisan, but it can be... It's not patently partisan. Yeah, it's political, as you were saying before. It's a political act, trying to make sure people have what they need.
Yeah, and it's just a part of the process. Like it has been said a million times, is that the grassroots element of it is to get people mobilized. To start either writing those letters or having a voice or sharing their stories. And it has to be connected to the political, because those are the powers that change those structures ultimately. So writing those letters to, you know, whoever the people are in power, you know, who can make those changes, they're connected. They cannot be disconnected. You have to have the people there. And it doesn't matter who they are, at least in my mind, that it doesn't matter whether they are affiliated with a church or affiliated with a group or whatever. We're affiliated with hunger. That's our affiliation. And so therefore we're allowed to be in there and have our voices heard.
Right. Yeah, that sounds good.
This week is the last week for most CSAs in Tompkins County. So the pickup, but I don't know if they have been alerted to notify their members that this is happening, because that would be a very logical place to reach out to the hundreds of people who are members of CSAs in Tompkins County. Mm. Thousands.
Great idea. We'll try to make that happen.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Well, I'm torn between promoting this offering of letters campaign, but also with just promoting more relationships around food. So maybe, I'm not sure, how can we get people to think about themselves, not only just as consumers of food, but producers of food in terms of how they prepare meals, but also in what they can do, even in an apartment building, to raise some food for themselves. I mean, we have such a disconnect in this culture, you know, for people, you know, food comes from a cooler in a supermarket. It doesn't come from a field. You know, the chicken is not an animal. It's this thing that you buy wrapped up in plastic. I mean, we don't have a relationship with our food. And yet the kinds of changes that we're trying to encourage in the food bill, in the farm bill, is for people to rethink not just what's provided to them, but what they're asking for, what they're demanding. How do we foster that?
So Eric, I'd like to jump in on that, because I'm not sure that the federal level we can change the culture, but we can do it locally. the food system became very prominent and local in everyone's mind when COVID came about. Everyone was impacted by the meat packers coming up with COVID and not being able to buy beef or meat locally or in a grocery store. You had to buy from local farmers. And so the food system, the vulnerabilities of the food system became very aware to everyone at that time. That was just when we were starting their work on developing the food system plan. And over the past 2 years, we've had over 2,000 Tompkins County residents participate in it. So there's a lot of interest and awareness about the food system and the vulnerabilities that we have locally. And we had just recently had a summit at Stewart Park, letting folks know that we were going to be describing our food system plan. We had 150 people show up to participate in that process. And some of them, Lori, will be speaking at your event as well. So they're already prepared, have their speech put together. So I just want to point out that I think the grassroots effort is going to have to be done. There's a lot we can do locally, and we can change our local food system. In Tompkins County, 94% of the land is used to grow food grows food for animals. This means there's a huge opportunity to grow food locally for our population. One of the goals of the food system plan is to double the amount of food that's produced locally, which then gets speaking to the fruits and vegetables and making them accessible and widely available to the full population of Tompkins County. So there are some real opportunities. We can leverage some federal and state money to do that, but a lot of it is just by local decisions and from institutions as well as individuals and where they're going to buy their food and supporting a food system that keeps us all healthy and our environment healthy as well.
You know, and we're so blessed in this community to have programs like the Youth Farm and to have Cooperative Extension doing so much work to help local people garden efficiently and successfully. So all of those things, you know, to Eric's point, could be amplified so that more people really get that amazing experience, that thrill of growing their own food, even if it's only a basil plant. But I think within our school districts, we've seen efforts for fruits and vegetables and for introducing young kids to a variety of foods. We've got all kinds of amazing things locally, but obviously we need to expand those and do them even with more vigor, I guess, and probably serve as a model for other communities as well. But it's here's just one little example. In my agency, Catholic Charities, we are part of the New York State Hunger Solutions system that funds a staff member to do outreach to sign people up for SNAP. She walks people through that process. She tables different places. She does all, publicity to help people who perhaps don't know they're eligible, don't know what it is, have a hard time getting the paperwork together. She helps to accompany them through that process to get people signed up for SNAP. And she signs up, usually over 100 households a year. So even in that process, and when we talk about how we might promote people to grow their own food, she can give out, sort of pens or bags, but she can't give out food. So it's not like she could say to people, and here's a homegrown tomato and you too. I mean, it's just the rule, good or bad, but I might argue maybe that's something that could be changed in terms of how we might promote SNAP with people. But as I understand it, she might be allowed to give out seeds, which could be, seed packet for greens, let's say, lettuce or greens, so that, there are some ways that if we could get that into more people's hands, that dream might become more of a reality. And of course, we have to realize for a lot of people, they don't have access to garden plots. They don't have access to a yard if they're living in apartments. So, that's another thing. That's another system of how do we get people to, even have a little small inside their house area that they can grow a plant or two. But it's all, I think it's all of a piece. We do some good work in this county, but, obviously we still have a long way to go.
Beaches, did you want to?
Yeah, I was thinking the same exact thing in terms of people not having access to or even the ability the physical ability to do things like that. And so how do we make sure that those people are still kept in the fold? And I think that part of it is not necessarily, if those are the people who can't have their own garden or don't want to have their own garden or can't physically because they're disabled, how do we still connect them emotionally and psychologically to fresh foods and good foods and nutritious foods? And that has to be part of the package as well. And this way they make different choices or buy locally or whatever it is that we're trying to kind of help them think differently about.
A couple of things come to mind. One is I don't know, I'm not sure on what the amounts are, but I believe the Park Foundation is funding every school district in Tompkins County for farm to table food so that the school districts will be providing a stream of fresh locally grown food, which is not happening in other parts of the country. And that's a big piece, but it's also a major tens of thousands of dollars for each district, but I'm not sure how much. The other piece is there's an attitude about food, which, you know, you want to learn to play with your food. And there's a beautiful book on making art out of taking fresh food and making art, and then you can eat it or make lemonade out of it or whatever you want to with it. But it's playfulness and it's having fun, and you don't need a garden. You might just need some soil. I mean, and put it in a window and see whether it grows or not. It's an experiment, you know. Mm-hmm. It's these kinds of playful approaches to things that are profoundly serious. Mm-hmm. Which I think is and for people who've never raised anything or seen mm-hmm. it grow, it's kind of wild. Even if it mm-hmm. dies and doesn't come to fruition, you know, it's just wild to watch the process. And we often don't encourage that kind of playfulness.
Yeah, and even to see the beauty. Even to see the beauty of the plant itself. And you made me remember that I actually grew potatoes in my home in Brooklyn. And just watching the plant itself form and grow and what it looks like different from other plants and things like that, that becomes part of the relationship with fresh food. It really can be. And especially for young people, it really does.
Yes, and that relationship results in a letter
of
influence as opposed to a meal that you can eat.
Yes.
Yeah. You know?
One thing I wanted to raise was the issue of food deserts and the importance of people being able to have access to fresh food. And I'm looking at an article from 2021 in WOVR 89.9's website. And it's talking about, it's from the perspective of, I think, a Cornell student. But it's talking about how the zip code 14850, which is the northwest and southwest areas of Ithaca, are technically considered a food desert because there's not a grocery store within a 1 mile radius. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's problematic because people who don't have access to a car don't have the ability to, you know, access a major grocery store. You know, those, and there's also now a new term called food swamp, which is even, I think, more evocative than food desert, because it relates to the idea that there are communities where food is available, but it's the wrong kind of food. Mm-hmm. It's the high mm-hmm. carbs and the high sugars mm-hmm. that contribute to diabetes and obesity mm-hmm. and high mm-hmm. blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And that those communities tend to be communities of color and low income, obviously low income communities. Mm-hmm. And so those are things that, you know, we need to be very aware of and very concerned about.
Right. And I guess I'm curious about how we can be effectively concerned about it. And there's a little factoid that's been bouncing around the back of my head. In the history of the United States, the end of every decade, the U.S. has been more urbanized than at the beginning, with one exception. From 1931 until 1930 to 1940, at the end of that decade, we were more rural.
Ooh.
It's the rate of movement of people to cities slowed, but people left cities where they could not get food. And they moved back to rural areas where they could at least raise or have access to family members or friends where they could survive. And with climate collapse kinds of issues, we need to think about how we share land. The food swamps and the food deserts, my sense is if we're talking about food, we can create demands or create awareness that can address those. It's good to have names for them because that it gives us something to aim at. But I'm not sure, do you have in mind specific things that we could do to address food deserts or food swamps?
Well, it's important to try to remedy those with grocery stores, for example. And those that can be difficult to do.
Right.
You know, there's land. There's the fact that major chains don't want to come into to urban areas because they see them as not as profitable or as dangerous. So gathering enough support to bring in a chain store or a family, you know, grocery store can be challenging, but trying to do that is important.
Right. I grew up in a town outside of a town with 1,000. We had 2 grocery stores. They were very well respected. They got a lot of support, but there is no grocery store in that town anymore. And what that has been replaced with is a convenience store. But there was enough demand that they now have a large aisle of fresh produce and fresh fruit. They have they have meats that are packaged elsewhere and brought there and sold, but they have tried to keep that from becoming a food desert. And it's in the 70 miles north of Kansas City, 30 miles from St. Joe, in the middle of nowhere. But there was enough demand, and the people know that, and they clear the shelves out as much as they can bring in. They are selling at this point, so there's some issue about getting more supply because the people want it.
Because I think part of it. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
To Don's issue. I mean, it's consumer, right, Don? It's consumer demand to say we don't just want Fritos. We want fresh fruits and veggies. And then, you know, yes, a smart owner of a retail grocery store is going to respond to that. But there has to be that demand, I guess, for people to recognize. Or maybe you just bring it to people and that helps create demand too.
That's right. Because sometimes it's not about it. The demand is there, the voice isn't heard, right? Because the demand might be there. People are sitting in their living room talking about, wow, we wish we had a grocery store, but they don't know who to bring that to. Who do you bring that to? Who do you say, who do you go, we need a grocery store or something? The other aspect of it is that when we think in terms of grocery stores and we talk about big markets, well, sometimes a small market would do. And so therefore, on the other end of those things, what we need to, I don't know if this is something in the purview of this conversation, but we also need to look at how do we help finance people who can run a smaller market for our community, and they don't have to have a major business, but they could have fresh produce and things like that. How do we help them get to that point? But the questions are there. I think that people don't know who to bring them to.
Right. And we did, there was an attempt to put a market on the north side of Ithaca, but it was too big. And it tried to bifurcate to serve high end and low end, but it didn't have a clear marketing strategy. And it probably wasn't reason. It was just simply probably too big for that space to do that. Lansing, which is just north of Ithaca, has a market that's barely surviving with, I think, some subsidies from local people who want to see it stay, but I'm not sure about its financial conditions, but it's always been touch and go. So finding a way to get fresh fruits and vegetables and food into some of these mini-mart kinds of places, which is what they did in Missouri, where I'm from, was they had to rethink their model. Of what they were offering, and they were the ones that could actually begin to do it and to fill some of the food deserts and to remove some of the swamp.
There's also the farmers markets, of which we need more nationally. We need farmers markets. You know, I'm remembering when I was a kid in Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania, the the fresh fruits and vegetables truck came down my grandmother's street. And, you know, she used to buy her fruits and vegetables right off the truck. It was a mobile farmer's market. Yeah. And that was great.
Yeah.
And I would guess that the carbon footprint of the truck going around was less than everybody going to pick up their share.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Although it was an old truck, so you don't know.
So let's go over one more time. What is happening on the 14th of November at St. John's Episcopal Church? What's up?
So on Monday, November 14th at St. John's on Cuba Street in downtown Ithaca, at 7 o'clock, we are holding an event to educate and activate people on the federal farm bill, which is going to be reauthorized next year. And Catholic Charities, Bread for the World, and other local faith groups are sponsoring this event, inviting the whole community, people from faith communities, as well as those who aren't involved in a faith community, but are people who want to address hunger in this country and around the world. We're inviting everybody to come down and hear from some local experts on issues around what we call SNAP, what we used to call food stamps, which is an enormous part of the farm bill. Does a lot of good, but we feel can be a lot more effective and help more people. On a program within the farm bill that would incentivize fruits and vegetables for low-income people who get some government assistance, but can't necessarily afford produce because it's more expensive than junk food. From organization involved in food distribution, the Friendship Donation Network, who's going to address this issue of food waste, which is also part of the food bill and how that has implications on climate change. And most especially how we as individuals and faith communities can get involved in advocating for this farm bill, the different steps we can take to ensure that the farm bill addresses not only feeding more people here in this country and around the world, particularly during this terrible era of droughts and fires and flooding that we're seeing around the world, but also how we can make that bill more sustainable and more equitable. So there's a lot in it, and there's a lot of good things to learn, and there are some great ways that people can get involved in order that our Congress coming in, the new congressional session coming in January, will begin to hear the voices of people from our district and our state to make that very, very big investment, our tax dollars at work, that enormous investment work better for more people.
Thank you. And Cherry, do you want to say anything in closing?
You know, I guess I would say that I think back to 1967 and Robert Kennedy's tour of the Mississippi Delta and his how he was able to shine a light on poverty and starvation in this nation and what that did for policy in this country. And I think that it is incumbent upon all of us now. We're grateful for what he was able to do and the policies that were enacted to curb the terrible poverty and the horrific starvation that was, you know, rampant in the Mississippi Delta and other parts of the country. So we're grateful for that. But we also know that we have still have major food insecurity that, you know, millions of our neighbors still face. And so we want to raise that issue up, and we want to ask other folks to raise that issue up and let that light shine, so to speak, so that there are handles that we can do something about it, and that all of us together would take some action to continue that legacy of improving the conditions of folks in this country around food insecurity. And we invite you all to join us on next week to start that effort. and continue and, that effort.
Yes, yes. And it's food insecurity, but it's also fostering, not just, it's addressing food insecurity, but also promoting healthy food, access to healthy food, and a lifestyle, a lifelong ability to take good care of one's body in a food system that has undermined us. Don, did you want to say anything to close, or Peaches?
No, I don't think I have anything to say other than I just do a plug for the food system plan work that we did. If folks go to Tompkins Food Future website, they can have find access to the food system plan and the executive summaries from the baseline work that we had created, which is a great educational tool and provide a lot of background for the work that's being talked about on Monday.
I just want to thank everybody for all the amazing information and for the event that's coming up. And I am going to go out and give you a huge plug and see if we can get more people coming in. And I just appreciate seeing and meeting all of you.
Yes, yes. And I want to note that this show is online at madeofclay.org. It's available. You can listen to it there. If you have comments or you want to get questions or observations to anyone who was on this panel, you can call 607-319-5445 extension 6 and leave a message, and we will get that to whoever you want to direct it to. Also, info@madeofclay.org if you want to send an email. Again, if you want to comment on this show or ask a question of anybody who has spoken, 607-319-5445 extension 6 or info@madeofclay.org. Thank you all. Thank you all. It's been good.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you so much, Eric and Peaches.
Take care. Bye. See you.
Bye bye.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain comes tumbling down. Pulling weeds and picking stones, man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, 'cause the time is close at hand. Grain for grain, sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain. Tune my body and my brain to the music from the land. Mother Earth will make you strong if you give her love and care. Old Crow watching hungrily from his perch in yonder tree. In my garden I'm as free as that feathered thief up there. Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch, row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain comes tumbling down.
Summer's got